You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Back in time we go now, to November 7th, 1963.
A United Airlines jet lands in Los Angeles, launching the biggest entertainment airlift in motion picture history. The world's press, some 300 newsmen from four continents, arrive for the Hollywood premiere of Stanley Kramer's Gentleman.
And that movie, made by a new-for-the-time 70mm single-strip Cinerama process, debuted a dome in L.A. that to this day stands in all its geodesic glory. But the Cinerama Dome, owned now by L.A.-based Pacific Theaters, is closed for good, as is its sister movieplex next door, the Arclight Hollywood, and Arclight and Pacific Theaters all over Los Angeles and the country. Pacific saying, quote, "This was not the outcome anyone wanted, but despite a huge effort that exhausted all potential options, the company does not have a viable way forward," end quote. The news sent shockwaves across Los Angeles. Angelino's taking to social media, lamenting, crying over the move. Matt Achety is general manager of Movie Phone and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. Hey, Matt.
Hello.
And Ben Schwartz, also known as Jean-Ralphio Saperstein, is an actor, comedian, writer, director, producer, you name it, and lover of film. Ben, thanks for being here.
Of course. I was also the voice of Movie Phone for like 20 years, right, Matt?
Oh, absolutely.
That was me for a while, yeah.
That was you, absolutely. Ben, Ben, you tweeted that Arclight Hollywood was your most favorite theater in the world to see movies. What is it about Arclight Hollywood, you know, and the Cinerama Dome that was right there, that's so special to you?
It is. You know what it is? I came from New York where the movie, or Yonkers, and then Manhattan, where the movie going experience is like, you know, you get a ticket, then you try to run to a seat as quick as you can. And then when I got to LA, Arclight was the first place where you could buy your tickets beforehand. You could pick exactly where you want to do it in the theater, and everybody has their phones off. It seems like everybody appreciates cinema and film, even if we're watching a silly comedy or if we're watching like, you know, a Marvel movie, everybody there to like just enjoy it so much. It feels like you're around cinephiles. So I loved that so much. Also in the movie theaters, if you ever go to the bathroom, they play like themes. So you could be taking like a poop to Indiana Jones, which is very exciting.
And everyone stays for the credits, right? That's one thing that I noticed years in LA when I first moved here. It was like, anywhere else I've lived, people leave as soon as the credits start rolling. In LA, everybody stays for the credits. They're looking for names of people they know.
Yeah, everybody waits for the end to listen to the song. And it's because so many people here work in the industry that they want to appreciate it to the last drop and then immediately talk about it in that fun, busy hallway or the lobby where you kind of run into friends and stuff like that.
Matt, the emotion of all of this is, you know, palpable, and, you know, Ben talks about it, and so many people took to social media yesterday and today, and they're obviously very sad about what happened. Talk about what's going on here. I mean, the owners say that they've exhausted all ideas for saving the theaters. They reportedly fired all their employees yesterday. How can we suddenly be hearing about this for the first time?
You know, it's, I mean, part of it is we haven't heard anything from the Arclight and a lot of other chains because of the pandemic. And LA's only recently said people can go back to the movies at partial capacity. There's a lot of theories going around. One theory is that Pacific Theaters and Decurion Corporation that owns both Pacific Theaters and the Arclight, and run by the Foreman family, who built the first, who built the dome back in the 60s, are playing hardball with their landlords. There was a recent report in IndieWire about that the Culver City Arclight location had been hit with an eviction notice for something to the tune of $182,000 rent that had been unpaid for March, which is a huge number. Which puts the rental cost just for that complex alone at over $2 million a year. the Hollywood location has to be pulling in, you know, more rent than that. So it could be a certain amount of hardball that the company's playing, but it's not a good sign that they've let their whole staff go. You know, this hits hard, I think, to a lot of folks on film Twitter that reacted both in the industry and those of us that write about it, because the Arclight Hollywood location is really, that's kind of where the cool kids go to the movies. Like, if you're in the industry, that's where you go. If, you know, there's so many media screenings there and critic screenings there, and the Grove, that's where I've probably seen more movies in the last few years than anywhere else. And there's a lot of Q&As that get done there. A lot of the trade groups and some of the guilds will have their screening series there. I also think that those screenings that would happen at both the Grove, but especially at the Arclight Hollywood, probably contributed a lot of extra money outside of just the regular business of exhibition. And I suspect that the Hollywood location and the Grove may have been disproportionately hit by the pandemic, because those screenings dried up. So over and above the fact that they can't show any movies and get that ticket rental cost, that whole separate line item was gone for a year. And I think that probably hit Pacific especially hard.
Pacific being an LA-based theater chain, if you're looking at other theater chains that would come in, swoop in and take over, because that's some of what you're seeing as well. You know, oh, please buy this chain so we don't lose it. AMC is based in Kansas City. Regal Cinemas is based in Knoxville, Tennessee. I mean, the thing about Pacific and Arclight specifically is the fact that they were LA. It was an LA theater chain, right? I mean, they know the film industry, and you could see it when you would go. I mean, Ben, talk about it. You would see, I mean, the attention to detail at these theater complexes, right?
Yeah, I think also what you have is a staff that really cares about films. Like, you go to the theater, and all the Arclight workers, whether, you know, they're giving you popcorn or, you know, shown to your seat, or they had their favorite movie pinned to their shirts, and you can discuss movies with them, and they care about the film also. And then before you go on, just like, you know, back in the day, you get an introduction, like someone comes in, welcomes you to the Arclight, you know, tells people to shut off all their things and gives you a quick little brief introduction of what this movie is going to be, who it stars. And it makes it like an experience, right? It makes it an experience, and it makes it feel special.
Yeah. I mean, and to add to that, Matt, I mean, what about, like, you know, a director like a Quentin? I mean, I keep seeing Quentin Tarantino or, you know, Mark Cuban, who owns the Landmark theater chain, you know, people like that who could come in and save the theater. I mean, are you hearing any of that?
Only what you see on Twitter, right? It could be that these locations will come back in some way. Landmark is probably, from a business sense, one of the better candidates to sweep that up. But, you know, let's keep in mind that the business of exhibition, of exhibiting movies, of showing movies, is touchy. But it's a great location, especially that Hollywood location. And even the Grove is a pretty solid location. You know, the Arclight and the Grove, those were prestige experiences. And it showed through, it kind of translated to those of us that cover the business, that are in the business. And I think that's why there's such emotion around the news.
Matt Achety, general manager of Movie Phone, co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day, and Ben Schwartz, actor, comedian, writer, lover of film too. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
And by the way, we reached out to the LA Conservancy and its director of advocacy, Adrian Scott Fine, to talk about the Cinerama Dome, its historic significance, and what can be done to save it.
We want to ensure that the building comes back in some type of entertainment venue, hopefully that they sell it to somebody that reopens as a theater. I mean, that would be our goal in terms of this. It is a designated historic cultural monument in the city of Los Angeles, so it has some protection, but that's no guarantee. As you know, there's a lot of development pressures throughout Hollywood right now. So I think the key question is that we want to see what limitations might exist in terms of its ability to reopen or find a new operator. But even if it's designated, it doesn't mean it's, you know, guaranteed protection. So that's why it's really important for people to speak out, talk to the council office for this district, and to look for options that can ensure it comes back as a, hopefully, as a theater operator.
Adrian Scott Fine, Director of Advocacy over at the LA Conservancy. This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. All right, let's talk about traffic now. It really is what we talk a lot about here in Los Angeles, like a lot.
I think you should go home now, Devin.
There's nothing going on, Stuart.
You should go home. Get back on San Vicente, take it to the 10, then switch over to the 405 North and let it dump you out into Mulholland where you belong.
That, of course, is Saturday Night Live, and yeah, it is a bunch of New Yorkers talking about Californians, but man, they are not far off base. Do you remember early on in the pandemic, more than a year ago, how empty the streets were at the beginning of all of this? Entire highways, free to roam, even at rush hour, on and off ramps, typically bumper to bumper, devoid of cars. Maybe you went for some bike rides or walks. It was nice for a bit, but that traffic seems to be back, and with it, the congestion. Have we not learned anything this year? Here to talk about it is Salida Reynolds, General Manager at the LA Department of Transportation. Hi, Salida.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. Mayor Eric Garcetti issued his Safer at Home order. I think we all remember this from March of last year. It was March 19th. We immediately saw the effect on traffic. I remember leaving the radio station, going home and getting on the freeway, the 10, and I knew the gravity of the situation because there were not very many cars on the freeway. But it really seems like things are back and back with a vengeance. How can that be when so many folks are still working from home?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I remember those moments too. They were sort of startling and eerie, but also there was something kind of incredible about experiencing a city without all of the cars and traffic and congestion that usually define it. What we know from a lot of research, actually, about people's patterns from work when they work from home is that at first, when they first begin working from home, they stop going out, they stop traveling during the mornings and the afternoons, particularly if you have a white collar sort of 9-to-5 job. But over time, gradually, they actually end up traveling more than they were when they went into their traditional office spaces, because they can run an errand in the middle of the day, or they can, take their kids to the park. They have more flexibility in their schedule, and it actually ends up that people are moving around more. And so I think we saw a little bit of that. And then at the same time, there were a lot of Angelenos who were still going to work. And we saw that on LADOT's transit lines. Many of our transit lines lost a lot of riders at the beginning of the pandemic, but there were a few, including the Pico Union line, where we still had a lot of people taking transit to get into their jobs as frontline workers and in healthcare and grocery stores. And then the other trend I'll point out, which is sometimes invisible to you, particularly if you're working from home, is that if you have the luxury of working from home, you probably are also ordering a lot of things to be delivered to your house. And when we looked at travel patterns in different parts of the city, we saw that on the sort of wealthier west side, people had the luxury of not traveling. But in South LA and many black neighborhoods and low-income neighborhoods in particular, people were driving more. And part of that was because a lot of those folks were the ones who have the jobs on the front lines. But the other part that was happening is that as people lost their jobs in the service industry or tourism, they began driving for tech platforms like Postmates, Caviar, Amazon, et cetera, because those were the jobs that were available. So there was actually more travel happening because of the rise of the dependence on those apps.
And your data, I mean, it shows that, right? I mean, you're seeing people who did lose their jobs, who did have to find another way to make money because they had no choice in the matter, right? They didn't have the luxury to work from home, having to go work for these gig economy apps, right?
That's right. Driving itself is a job. And that was true before the pandemic, of course, but it became even more true during and afterwards. And now as I think everybody in LA can see and feel, traffic levels are back to about 90% of what they were pre-pandemic.
90%. I mean, how do you measure that?
Well, we actually have one of the most sophisticated and expensive traffic management centers, definitely in North America, maybe in the world, that we actually built for the 1984 Olympic Games, and it's called ATSAC. So, for example, at the beginning of the pandemic, what we saw when you were seeing all of those empty roads, what I was seeing was a huge increase in the number of people who were driving at really high speeds, because without the turbulence of congestion to slow people down, they were able to go really fast. And what that means is that we saw a steady increase in the number of people getting injured and killed on the streets. And so we made some citywide adjustments to the traffic signals. So, you know, if you've ever gotten what people call a green wave and you feel like you sort of won the lottery if you're driving, or even in some streets if you're biking, we got rid of those because what that was leading to was even more speeding and even more traffic crashes, which is really one of the main things that we're trying to solve for, is to reduce completely the number of people who die from traffic crashes in LA.
Yeah. What are you guys doing, before we let you go, Salida, what are you guys doing to look forward? I mean, and the things that you all have learned during this time, this dreadful time that we've been all dealing with?
Well, I think one of the things we learned was how to deliver projects faster. So during the pandemic, we were able to deliver a really large number of new miles of protected bike lanes, of transit-only lanes. So if we're going to prioritize the thing that moves the most people, which is a bus on our city streets, you know, buses are no good if they have to sit in the same traffic as everybody else. So giving them their own lanes, improving streets for people who walk and bike and take transit, to try and set the table for people to maybe reconsider as they return to their old routines, or as they make new routines, to have a fresh, you know, way of thinking about how they get around. We need to give them a street that gives them the confidence that they can make a different choice, and that, that, you know, their lives will be better, that it will be safe, and that it actually might be enjoyable to get from A to B in Los Angeles.
From your lips to God's ear, right?
Yes, that's right. Amen.
Amen. Salida Reynolds, General Manager at the LA Department of Transportation. Salida, thanks for being on with us. We appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
Well, now we're joined by another person who spends his day thinking about the streets, this time from a non-governmental point of view. Michael Manville is professor of UCLA's Department of Urban Planning. Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What are you seeing on the streets and in the mass transit of Los Angeles? I mean, does congestion seem as bad as it was pre-pandemic? You heard Salida say 90% back.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think what we're seeing, you know, in the last few months, especially as things have started to open up, a return to some of the congestion we were familiar with, you know, over a year ago. I agree that it's not quite as bad as it was before. But yeah, I think our streets are starting to get clogged for sure.
So when you listen to what she had to say over at LA Dot, what are your takeaways? I mean, the department, she says, has made progress with the protected bike and bus lanes, although she says, you know, we want more, obviously. Are you happy with what's been done, or do you wish that there are bolder changes on the way?
Well, I think it's always hard to make the transition from a city really laid out for the automobile, and where most voters are accustomed to moving around by car, turning that into a vision more like the one Salida laid out is always difficult. But no, as someone who studies this, but also as someone who is a cyclist and a pedestrian, Los Angeles has a very long way to go. Again, I do think in some ways that's an artifact of where we're starting from, but we are not a bold moving city in this regard at all.
LA is the second largest city in the country, second largest metropolitan area in the country. What other cities would you look at that LA can look to and say, hey, look, this is the way we need to do it?
Well, I think, you know, you can look up and down the West Coast, and almost any large city is more aggressive in terms of taking back space from cars and making room for bikes and pedestrians and buses than we are. You know, so that could be Seattle, it could be Portland, of course it could be San Francisco. You can look at the conversion of streets in Boston to bus lanes in Philadelphia. And a lot of the obstacles here are not coming from Salida's organization, right? I think there's a lot of political pushback. There's a lot of resistance on the part of different members of the city council. You know, it wasn't that long ago that one of our city council members said that Beverly Boulevard was too narrow to hold bike and bus lanes. You know, this is like a six-lane street. You know, whereas you see cities in the Northeast that are taking very narrow streets and giving lanes over to buses. So I think we have if you're asking, you know, where else can we look for examples? And I would say almost anywhere.
You said something a little while ago, though, that really caught my attention. And you said voters. You used the word voters. And I wonder if that's sort of a, you know, you're trying to allude to the fact that people who actually are engaged in the political system are the ones who have the cars, are the ones who use those freeways and don't necessarily use mass transit or the bike lanes, stuff like that. And that's why the situation is the way it is in L.A.
I think it's a part of it. And I also think I should be a little bit more nuanced. I think that some of the loudest participants in these processes are drivers, right? I think that one problem with our political system in general at the local level is that we undervalue and underestimate people's indifference. You know, right? So if the city proposes a bike lane or a traffic calming measure like they did over in Mar Vista a few years ago, you might get a small number of people who are, you know, really enthusiastic about it, and a small number of people who just act as though the world is ending. But if you look at the number of people who live in that area, the main thing you would take away from looking at the numbers is that most people just didn't care, right? And I think that doesn't work its way into our political calculus. And I think that we don't fully appreciate, you know, how much most people don't mind, you know, either way, if something like this happens.
You think people working from home will change the equation? If more people are doing this, if you're able, you have that luxury, as we say, to be able to do your job from a computer at home, and you're not traveling, especially at peak traffic times, that's going to be a game changer in and of itself.
Well, I guess there's two things to say to that. One is that we're still not sure exactly how much work at home we're going to see coming out of the pandemic. And I think we'll see more than we saw beforehand. But I also think that a lot of firms do want their people back at work. And I think a lot of people are tired of being at home and want to be back in the office. But assuming that we see a slightly higher level of telecommuting or working from home going forward, working from home is not the same as being locked in your house, right? And one thing we know from travel diaries and other sorts of evidence that people might like me look at is that people who work from home don't hop in the car and commute to work. They do, over the course of the day, hop in the car and do a bunch of other stuff.
Which is what Salida said. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they'll go meet their friends for breakfast. They're going to run that errand. This is when they're going to do their dentist appointment. And so it is the case that if you convince someone or allow someone to work from home, they may not pull onto the 405 at 8 a.m. But we should remember that, one, someone else probably will pull onto the 405 at 8 a.m. if they don't, right? We live in a region of millions of people who want to go places. And two, not going to work is not the same thing as not getting in your car.
Michael Manville, professor of UCLA's Department of Urban Planning. Michael, thanks for your time today, too. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's going to do it for us today. Whew. Tomorrow, we're starting a new series about the stories behind some of LA's street names. You don't want to miss the first one. To the northern San Fernando Valley we go, in a little street with a big, bold name. That's tomorrow. You never have to miss any episode of GLA, by the way, because you can find them all online. Get the show fresh to your feed on the regular by subscribing to the podcast, too, at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Let us know how you're doing. What are your memories of the Cinerama Dome or the Arclight? Or here's another one. Have you been fully vaccinated? What are or will you be doing that's different than you've been doing for the past year? KCRW.com. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, John Meek, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Amy Todd, Jody Adler, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on the show today. Thank you for your ears and time. I'm Steve Chiotakis. We'll talk to you tomorrow.